travelers, and welcome to the Thief vs. the Stars podcast. On today's special show is returning champion Marty Matchless. You know him from the TV show Evil, where he plays George and the Devil Therapist. You can now find him on Studio 666. He also hints at a future project of a famous sci-fi franchise that we cannot talk about at this moment. So come join me as we go traversing the stars. Hello, Mr. Matchless. Thank you so much for coming back to the Vs. the Stars podcast.
Hello. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
You're the returning champion.
Yes. I want all the numbers.
It's greatly appreciated. Like I said, you're awesome. You do so many great characters, and it's nice that I get to talk to you this time.
Yeah, appreciate it. Good to meet you.
You as well. So first question I always ask is, what inspired you to become an actor, and who were your earliest influences?
Oh, man. Well, I'll go the second part first. My earliest influences were probably the Disney's animated Robin Hood character.
Oh, really?
It was probably the first film I ever saw in a theater as a wee pup. And then I got the long playing record that I would listen to over and over and over and over. And then I started like actually playing with his accent when I was like 5-year-old kid. So,
well, that's cool.
I think that was the first one.
Did you think you were going to become an animated person?
Man, I probably hoped, you know, like the fox tail, the bow and arrow ability. He was cool as shit. I love that.
He was.
Can we say bad words? I should have asked you.
Oh, go for it.
All the words. We know all the words on this show. Okay, great.
All fair. So what inspired you to become your actor from Robin Hood?
I think it was, you know, me as a kid thinking like, oh, you can fart around and play characters, and kind of just got my little brain thinking about that. But I think it was probably watching like Star Wars when I was a kid, because I got a hold of the fan magazine Bantha Tracks, and I started realizing, wait a second, this is a process and people are actually making this. Which means to me that the people aren't the real people. They're actually doing something to become the real people. And that also started making me think like, right. This is a learnable skill.
Yeah. Star Wars is such a wonderful franchise.
Oh my God. I think it set the course.
Yeah. I think so many people who are in writing and movie making, a lot of them can go back and say Star Wars, that first Star Wars. I mean, I was a little older. I think my first Star Wars movie I actually saw probably was Return of the Jedi, is my guess. Cause I was three for that one. I think I was New Hope's before my time, but still the movies,
young they pups. Stay with you.
Yes, I am. I'm just a mere child of 42.
Yeah. Well, it hit me like at 7 years old for the first one. And then I was like, what was it? 9 or when was the next one? 90 or 79,
80. And I think 83.
80. Yeah. So it was 10, like Empire. I didn't know what to do with, cause that was the first movie I'd ever seen as a 10-year-old where it didn't end well. Like, you mean we don't get to resolve this on a happy note? You mean Han Solo's gone and maybe, So at first I hated it, but then I was obsessed with watching it over and over and over, which also helped, because like, I don't know if you've gone back to Empire Strikes Back recently, but the framing, the cinematography, and the like just building the frames, there's some gorgeous frames in that movie.
Yes.
Like it's a film as well as just a kind of, you know, B sci-fi movie as well.
So for our younger listeners, there was a time before social media when a movie like Empire Strikes Back came out with a cliffhanger, you literally had 3 years of not knowing what was going to happen. What did that feel like to be in the void of not knowing these things?
What was fun about it, and like I said, the only connection was this fan zine. It was a printed magazine, and it must have only come out like once a month or once every few months. Like it just kind of like kept you going just a little bit. And then beyond that, it was just kids at school. You know, my buddies and I'd be like, you want to go play Star Wars after school? Like, let's go play Star Wars after school. We'd get our guys out. And like, it's like we kept that going ourselves through intention. It wasn't just like being fed social media to try to keep us engaged. We kept ourselves engaged and we were really excited about it.
So you had the action figures as well?
I didn't go nuts like some of the friends that I had, but you know, I had my special. I had like the 2-layer kit. I didn't have like the Darth Vader head kit or multiple boxes, but I had like my one kit of however many, you know, 40 guys was in there.
Right.
Yeah. I had my guys. I still remember which guns go with which guys to this day.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Hand me an IG-88 and a stack of guns. I could pick his like that.
Well, you know, I could make a comment about geekdom, but for me, I have a curio cabinets in my front room loaded with toys behind the curio cabinets on special stand posed.
Yeah.
Because I'm that level nerd.
It's a fun aspect. It's a fun aspect of fandom, you know? Like,
yeah.
I don't have a super collection of anything these days, but like I appreciate it. I appreciate the artistry. I appreciate some of the kind of the offshoot style things that they build just as a specialty. Like there was a variant series, like larger size Darth Vader, Boba Fett, Stormtrooper. They're kind of like almost samurai styling. It's cool. It gives people a lot of good creative fodder.
That, I mean, I really do enjoy that. And one thing I kind of was wondering about, once again, we're talking there were video games back when you were, I mean, in 1977, 1980. I think Odyssey, early Sega. I mean, early Atari. But for the most part, action figures were the outlet. So when you're playing and imagining these characters doing their thing, in any way, do you think that helped lead to how to become an actor when you're playing these characters?
I think there's certainly an aspect of that kind of creative play that gets your mind thinking the right direction. You know, you used to come up with the voices. We didn't have, again, like there was no internet to just sit there and watch somebody else's creativity. We came up with our own voices, our own scenarios. We got pretty elaborate, like with, you know, setting strings all around my room that they could slide down.
Nice.
I sacrificed a few to firecrackers back in the day when you could blow things up without much repercussion. it does. I think it does help your creativity, where a little bit of that has been lost these days with kind of like where everything exists inside and is being presented to us instead of like the olden days where it's like, go outside and figure out something, get a rock and a stick and go play. Right.
Yeah. I think I was right on the edge of that generation because, like, so for me, we had the Atari. Nintendo was coming in when I was 10, 11, which was when Nintendo hit their thing. But there's that nice window there where the computer, you know, the video games were still, you know, not quite big in graphics. It basically still was toys, action figures that handled your imagination.
You bet.
And, you know, and I kind of think I felt better that was the case.
It was fun. Yeah. I mean, I look back at them now. I'm like, what did we ever do? All they did was just kind of move up and down like that. They weren't what they are now. Of course, nowadays, you know, even today, I'll seek out like those like 42 jointed hyper figures.
Yes.
That, like you can really pose. That's pretty exciting too.
Yeah. Like McFarlane Toys has those that are like the hyper detailed, the ones that are toys, but they're too expensive to break. So you can't play with them.
Yeah. Pose them once and then just walk away slowly.
Make sure no piece falls off. Though I will say that stupid Spawn cape broke and I'm so upset by it to this day.
Happens. Yeah. Happens. Hard to keep them all good.
Indeed. So you actually earned a degree in elementary education from California State University. So you were going to become a teacher first, it sounds like.
Yeah, I was kind of parallel tracking it. You know, I was doing, I was a musician all through school. I played trombone. I was in the choir. So there's always kind of an arts background. But then I got into theater right about the time that girls seemed to be really interesting. And like that combo is just unbeatable. And then I realized, well, you know, acting, that seems just like playtime, so I should probably have a career. So I was on the elementary education track for a while, and I don't teach, but I still have, you know, I'm involved with kids, like my nieces and nephews have a superb uncle in me, and like I'm always working with kids, and taught some theater, directed some kids theater, worked with a developmentally disabled children program for a while. Like, so it's been a through line, just not direct track to public education.
Yeah, you know, I'm a teacher myself. I'm a high school, a special needs high school teacher. So nice. I think that's so cool. And the fact that you taught theater, is there something that you see with kids growing up learning, trying to learn the act and performance skills that either is the most difficult part for them? Do you think it's just the outward shyness of it all?
It's a difficult thing, and I think it's case by case and not like a consistent thing that I've seen. Like I remember specifically this one play that we did, the loudest, most like, I am a performer kid, had the hardest time getting all the lines and getting her character down. The most shy, kind of standoffish, like, I'm too tough, I'm too cool for this. He was great. So I think it's just more, and you might attest to this, like as a teacher, you just kind of have to find the way in to the particular kid who's standing in front of you. Like, you know, you learn their lingo, you learn if they're trying to cover for something, if they're really shy or if they're having an issue, like whatever it is, you can kind of help maybe bridge that towards their kind of creativity and how to get them to just play and just open up to it.
You know, one thing I find consistent when I do these interviews, because I've had the fortune of interviewing a lot of actors for this podcast and when I was on another podcast. And the one thing I find that's kind of consistent with a lot of actors is that surprisingly, a lot of them are introverted.
Are
introverted.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that to be
tremendously so.
Yeah, and I find it to be like a weird, the most like oxymoron thing possible.
Yeah, you know? It says it seems to be like really strongly either direction. You get like super performers, look at me, or like in my case, I was the quiet little kid who would like sit alone and wanted to figure out how things worked. Right, like I would tear things apart and look at them and try to figure it out. And then once acting became a conscious thought of something that could be figured out, I'm like, okay. I'm going to figure this out. I'm really nervous. I know that probably sucked because I'm really nervous. How can I fix that? Right. It was always something to kind of fix and build and work on and improve.
How long did it take for you to try to get over that shyness and anxiety of act performing?
The date today is February. I'm still the shy kid inside. Like there are days when I'm like, oh God, I don't know what the hell I'm doing. I don't even know why they're hiring me to do this. Someone's going to find it. It's imposter syndrome every day. And the older I get, the less I want that to disappear. Like I want to feel like I got to work and bust my ass to make it happen. Right. And it just keeps me engaged. You know, I don't ever want to be complacent and think I can slide and like think I'm great because each role should be a fresh challenge and a fresh experience and should bring to bear new skills and new talents. Like you got to learn all the time or kind of what's the point?
I mean, you've done so many roles. I mean, you've been in so many different things. A lot of those characters that you've played using the correct term prosthetics, right? Or makeup, I guess. I don't know if you call that a special effect characters or prosthetic characters, but you've done a lot of them. You became most known for that. What is it about your skills in makeup that you think has made you so valuable in those type roles?
As near as I've been able to figure it myself, and then also with the feedback I've received from my makeup artist friends over the years, what they're looking for is someone who is patient in the chair, who's not going to fidget, who's not going to destroy their makeup, someone who's conscientious of their work, right? And as a kid I used to love putting on stuff myself for Halloween, trying to get disgusting or make something look cool. Like, and I recognize how hard that was for me. So the very first opportunity I ever got to sit down, I realized like, oh my God, these guys are amazing. And they're trusting me to sit there and then they're going to put this stuff on me. I better do whatever I can to make it look good. So I think a lot of that kind of attention towards their work and respect of their work has done well for me amongst the makeup crew, you know, the world that I'm in. And being patient, like I said, non-claustrophobic. A lot of this stuff is really restrictive and kind of constricting. So it's helpful if you can just kind of like chill out and go to your happy place and recognize you're going to be out of it in anywhere from 6 to 14 hours sometimes. And then just to have acting chops, right? Like you can put anybody in a makeup, but unless they know what to do in it, how to move it, how to manage themselves, it's going to look kind of like just rubber masky and dead. So those things help.
So when you're in your prosthetics and you're trying to act, because that is restrictive in your facial features, how you move your face, maybe even how you move your body, how consciously do you have to change how you perform when you're in prosthetics or makeup?
I'm very conscientious about it. And unfortunately, with the pacing of most of the things I've done in TV, they're like on the clock, like checking on you. How soon is he going to be ready? Okay, great. He's ready. Okay, ready. Let's go to set. And then I'm like, wait a second. From the end of makeup to like shooting, where's my time to like figure this out? Right, so right. I'm always asking for like, okay, yeah, but pad 10 minutes. Like give me 10 minutes to see the full complete thing. So when I don't quite get that in the makeup chair, once everything's glued down and the paint is largely finished, I'm already kind of like going, you know, I'm testing what I know of how my movements translate to whatever the thickness is of the piece. You know, if it's a very thick silicone piece, I'm gonna have to like turbocharge my eyebrows and really make them work. And then just see how it reacts and then try to remember like, all right, with this character, I've got to do 50% more everything. Or in the case of like Evil with George, the piece was so thin, it was basically just, it would do whatever I did. so I could express as naturally as I do normally, and he would read.
You know, I find it so amazing that they wouldn't give you that kind of window. I always would assume you'd had a chance to perform.
Wouldn't it be nice?
Practice and rehearsal with your makeup. Also, because I can't imagine, yeah, you know, not knowing how to perform, not knowing how I look and trying to act. You know, you figure the appearance is just as much a part of the performance as what you want to say or do, you know?
Sometimes you get a little extra time. Sometimes, well, also, fortunately, you know, even if they're in a rush, usually that rush is to go out for like a rehearsal or blocking rehearsal. And then they're like, okay, we'll call you. And then I get to go back and sit around and do what most people do, is just like twiddle their thumbs for an hour or whatever. So as soon as that happens, I'm like, give me a mirror. Let me go sit down. Let me see what I'm doing. So I'll find the time somehow, even if I have to say, like, I have to go to the bathroom for a bit. Like, I'll stand there. And like, okay, got it. Good. Wherever you can find the time.
Is it, you think part of the issue is that most directors have never had to perform in prosthetics? They don't understand the difficulty of doing so?
Probably. I mean, yeah. I mean, that's got to be an aspect of it. I think that there's not enough time during the development of a lot of these things to say, oh yeah, right, there's a guy who's going to be involved in this process, and after that, he needs a certain thing. It's more like, we got a creature? Okay, great. I'm not going to think about that anymore. I'm going to think about setting up my day and getting my shots and all that. Like, it's just not, and reasonably so, it's just not part of their routine or their consciousness for getting their day. So it is largely, I think, my responsibility to request that time if I need it, or just find a way to get it myself. But there are certainly times, and there were times with certain directors, like back on Sleepy Hollow and a lot of cases on Evil, where they are conscientious about it, and you'll go out and have like a full rehearsal, and you know, there is some time. Just with the pace of TV in general, it's kind of hard.
Now I know some actors become directors. So have you had a director that themselves were experienced in doing those kind of prosthetic roles, and did they handle you differently because of that experience that they had?
Well, there's this guy you might have heard of, Peter Weller.
Yes, I know Peter Weller.
Aha, Mr. RoboCop himself. He came out to do an episode of Sleepy Hollow. And so I felt like, and he's such a character, like it was equal parts pure entertainment listening to that dude tell stories all day long, as well as understanding that he knew what was going on with me, and that if I had any kind of a thing related to what was going on, I'd be like, hey, Peter, you know, I need like 5 seconds just to catch my breath or whatever. It does help. You know, I think the more well-rounded you are as a director, the better off everybody's going to be throughout the day, because you just kind of have like a little more, not even concern, but just an awareness of what everyone's going through and what they might need in a given moment, even if they're not expressing it to you.
Have you ever considered going to directing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I haven't. I feel like I should also have a project to develop and then direct that project. So I've got a few things I'm scribbling on right now, but my background also, I've spent 20 years as an editor, and I fell into that the day Final Cut Pro 1.0 or whatever it was came out back in, was it like 99? I got a hold of an evaluation copy and started playing with it. And I'm like, wait a second, I can film things with my DV camera. I can practice acting. So I thought I could practice acting, but the very first thing I did, I grabbed a couple of Hot Wheels. I'm like, okay, I could do a chase scene, just something to practice. I stayed up all night with a PlayStation, grabbing sound effects, and like I had music. And like the very first thing I ever cut was this nice little chase scene with Hot Wheels. I'm like, wait a second, this is great. I like this power. Yeah,
you know,
yeah, it's fun.
The one thing, when I started doing my own podcast, I had to learn to edit these shows. And the one thing I learned as being part that was most difficult is patience. And I'm wondering, as someone who's used to being in chairs for a long time with this makeup stuff, if that's the same kind of personality that does lend itself to editing, which is a very slow, patient process and very, you gotta be very careful at all times with it. The moments matter. I wonder if that does connect to also why you do so well as in these type of roles. And makeup.
It's a similar thing. I think if you were a kid who enjoyed hanging out in your room by yourself playing with Legos, you're probably going to be an excellent editor. If you were an only child, also doing that, you might have a little more difficult time directing, unless you maybe had a sports background or, you know, like the drum meet, you know, some sort of leadership position growing up. Because like being the shy kid, didn't have that so much. I think now as an older kid, directing seems a lot more appealing, but I think that social component is probably what kept me from it for a long time until I thought I knew enough of the skill set required to actually be of some value as a director of a project.
You know, the another thing I noticed about you as an actor, and you are phenomenal, is, you know, is that you do, you know, you're great with horror, and you're so great with comedy. I mean, the characters of George and the Devil Therapist and Evil are great characters. You know,
I love George. I love George.
Yeah, I mean, they're really, really fun characters. And when you're, once you dress up these characters, is does that make comedy even harder? Because comedy is so much, once again, in the moment and timing and just the details of comedy. And I think comedy is also underappreciated by a lot of actors because of how, and I think it's way more difficult than people think it is. Is that even harder to do in the prosthetics and all this makeup?
Yeah, well, I think, yes, the short answer is for sure. I think that comedy, if it doesn't read through the face, you've got to be able to do something with your physicality that isn't kind of over the top and gratuitous and is kind of more subtle. With George in particular, like I said, since his expressions would read, but also because George was pretty much the first time in my entire career where I've had enough opportunity to build the character with the creative team, with Joel. Like Joel did all the makeup and design and whatnot. And then once we were in it and saw what it looked like, I could help develop and, you know, offer ideas and suggestions based on what they were giving me in the script and what they wanted to then come up with this character. So in playing with that and recognizing that I had some input and I had some creativity that I could offer, there were moments during the shoot of the pilot, let's say, where George kind of is presented the first time, where I could see an opportunity and go, hey, what if we did it like a little bit more this way, and then maybe flip this around? And Robert King directed the pilot, and he was absolutely receptive to everything. Also recognizing, he's like, yeah, what's it going to hurt? You know, if I don't like it, I won't use it. But always receptive to anything. And I did find in the edit that they did take those suggestions of a couple of those things that turned out funnier, I think, for the additional contribution, which was awesome. Like, it was a good confirmation for me as an actor too, that I was like, oh yeah, I have an idea of what might be funny. And lo and behold.
Well, I think it's great that there's a director that is receptive to ideas. I wonder if a lot of them are. I mean, we'll see. I'm obviously not in the industry myself, just for many reasons, but I just wonder if how receptive a lot of directors are. And I wonder if the receptive ones really are the best.
Certainly the best from an actor's standpoint. It's the best when, you know, you have these ideas and you just want to toss them out there, and they can give you a few minutes to try it out. From a collaborative standpoint and getting everybody through their day, it certainly does help if they are open to things, right? Like, I don't think maybe once or twice ever in my entire career have I had someone who is more ego-driven than he could allow for other creative input, which I understand if someone is going more towards that angle, like, this is mine and I'm going to, you know, steer the ship and fuck everyone else, then, you know, you're not going to get what you want, because not everybody else is going to be receptive to helping you steer that ship all by yourself. Because, you know, ideally, which I think is a hallmark of really great directors, you know, let's say like Ridley Scott, he brings in his team all the time because he's got that shorthand and he knows the strengths of people, and he wants those people to step up and offer and kind of add their 52 cents to everything. It just makes a better project all in all when you can guide it with a very firm hand, but then allow for input. Ideal world, that's the kind of directing I would like to see more of and also offer.
Well, last week I had a really cool opportunity to interview BJ McDonald. He did Studio 666, and he was a very awesome dude.
Good. So much energy. Was he on fire?
He definitely. I mean, like I said, he has tons of energy. It's one of those times where you're interviewing someone definitely way cooler than I am. So I'm just like, I got to bring my game. He's way cooler than I am.
He's awesome. Yeah, he's a good guy.
So you got to play the caretaker in Studio 666. Can you kind of tell the listeners a little about the movie and your role?
Yeah. Caretaker. He's kind of this undercurrent through line character that pops up as kind of the nemesis of Dave Grohl, and or the thing that possesses Dave Grohl, and or the thing that is spoiler alert, vomited out. But like things happen with this caretaker kind of threading through it in various forms. Yeah, tons of fun. That was one of those gigs where initially, as a lot of work that I've had comes to me via the makeup artist relationships that I have. So Tony Gardner, amazing, amazing practical special effects guy, runs a shop. We'd worked at a San Diego Comic-Con thing at one point, and based on that, he remembered me as the certain type of physique or whatever ability, and he called me up about it. He's like, hey, there's this thing. Do you want to try the thing? So I sent my stuff, and then it came together from that. Wasn't quite sure at the offset, like, what was going to be involved. So as I was reading the script, I'm like, wait a second. There's that caretaker again. Wait, is that caretaker this guy? Is it? Oh, this is great. Fight with Dave Grohl. Yes. Hard yes. No questions about it.
So, I mean, Let's get the movies. You're in it with the Foo Fighters. How fun that movie must have been. So much fun to shoot.
Crazy fun. Yeah, it was a bit of a weird stop and start. You know, we had a very short time before the pandemic became a thing, and then we stopped and waited until all the security things, safety things came into play, and then we restarted. But yeah, I mean, the little bit I actually saw the guys, hung out with Dave maybe more than anybody else, but they're all fun, you know, rock dudes and people in movies and horror buffs in general. Like, we're just a bunch of kids who like cinema and, you know, gory stuff. And everyone was really great on it. Yeah, they were a lot of fun.
Now, were you a Foo Fighter fan at all prior to the movie of the music?
I can't claim fandom. I can claim, you know, general pop awareness. Certainly they were kind of, you know, on the radar, but more so after, of course. Like, I immediately was like, oh crap, I gotta hit the library and listen to everything now.
So when we talked to them, we were like, oh, of course I know that song. Yeah, that's a great song. You're like,
oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, hey, right, yeah. That one, that was a good one. Spotify, listen to that real quick.
So one great thing about the movie, and I did have a chance to see, which was great. They sent me a screener copy, so I got to watch it.
Nice.
It's a combination of horror and comedy, which is such a cool mix. For someone who's done so much of it, why do you think that's such a great mix of genres, comedy and horror?
I mean, I'm not just an overt horror fan at all, because it just wears on me. I think too much of that starts to feel like I don't want to experience this darkness for 2 hours straight. You know, it does provide the levity, and also it provides the opportunity for the dark stuff to be so over the top that without that levity, you'd just be utterly repulsed and have PTSD as you walked out of the theater. But slapping it into a comedy framework, you know, then you have those crazy highs where you just recoil in horror at certain scenes that we were aware of from this movie, and then take a break and listen to the guys joke around. So I think it does lend itself, you know, like the Scream series or any of those kind of combo horror comedies are the direction I would go. My preference for watching horror is definitely those.
Well, that's why Nightmare on Elm Street is so much fun. I mean, Freddy Krueger is a funny character. Yeah. That's why he's always superior to Jason and Michael Myers, because he has a personality. He's funny. And even though he's scary, he does pull up the lines of 2 and 2, and you're just like, you know, and you laugh, you know, it's fun. There's no catharsis in the middle of all the horror.
Doing horrible things and cracking wise about it. You know, that there's also some of that aspect in Evil that I think they do so well. It's like they kind of ride that line between, like, this is a horrific thing, like threatening a child with a knife, and then she's making jokes. You're like, there's no, you know, big I think that's it. It doesn't seem like psychologically there's a big consequence, even though you're seeing something awful happen, if there's all this humor around it. It's more like Looney Tunes.
Yes.
I know that Wile E. Coyote's not going to die when he falls off a cliff and smashes into the ground. Like, he's going to be okay.
That would have been a shocking ending to one of these episodes. You know, after all that buildup, to be like one episode where he just dies and just ends it there. And they go,
whack!
Right, just and then the credits come up. You're like, oh, shit. I've been horrible to do some poor kid.
There's got somebody has to have already taken that angle with Looney Tunes, where it's just utter gore fest.
You know,
if not,
that would make a hell of a horror movie. The Looney Tunes horror movie.
yeah. Hard R Looney Tunes. Sorry, kids.
Would you do it animated, or would you do live action prosthetics? That's a big question there.
Oh God, that actually could be fun. I used to think years and years ago it'd be really fun to have like a Halloween costume made up of, oh God, I'm gonna blank on his name. He was Pete the Puma. Remember Pete the Puma character? He dressed up like a pseudo rabbit to get the little tiny rabbit that Bugs was protecting, but he had like blades of grass, and he had this giant wolf mouth, and he had this really kind of weird voice.
I think live action is the way to go.
Action is the way to go.
You know what? You should definitely be pitching the horror movie Looney Tunes live action horror film.
Hey, BJ, get an idea for this movie.
The killer would definitely have to be Bugs because it just works better that way.
Oh, God, right? Dark Bugs.
Ooh.
This is good. I'm liking this.
But take notes, and if someone steals it from us, I'm suing them. Yeah.
And like Daffy's always such a nervous dude, he could just be in terror the whole time.
That would be a great moment for it. That'd be a great character in the horror. It's just the anxiety there.
Then
you got all the characters you need. You have Elmer Fudd, who is always that horror guy that you have to hate and has to get died in the most horrific way possible. It's all right there. This is up to you now. This is all
you. It's happening. It's done. We've already done it. Perfect. I like this.
Yeah. So when you are in a TV show or a movie, do you actually watch it yourself, like the one that you're already in? Or are you one of those people? Because some actors I know can't watch themselves on screen. Mm. Some can. Which one are you?
I have pretty healthy ambivalence towards what I'm doing. Like, because I think I have a background that I do, I like to see what they've done with the pieces to see if I can remember what was going on in the day and kind of like back time it to what I was thinking at the time and see if it plays out like I imagined it might to help me do things better for the editor and give them better pieces the next time. Right. Mm. Like I try to kind of reverse engineer it after the fact and see if I can improve my work that way. I'm not like nervous about it or ego-y about it. It's just, it's like, it's useful information, you know, but like if I miss a show because I'm too busy, I'm like, all right.
Well, I would say I'm in a small way. I do comic book writing. I publish a few things. I will say I find it a little difficult sometimes to read my own stuff. I find it easier for other people, but with yourself, I find you tend to find the flaws faster than anybody else is going to. You know, as an actor, are you looking at, you know, you find yourself finding what you're doing more likely what you're doing wrong, or you find yourself more likely what you're doing right?
Oh, I think I'm definitely predisposed to looking for flaws, right? Like I'm thinking about Studio 666, and when we were at the premiere, I'm like, oh God, here it comes. I remember that scene. Wait a second. This is the first time I'm going to see my head that big up on a screen. Crap. And like, I remember when it's the Greg Knoll flashback down in his cave doing his little thing with the book. I'm like focused on this line because I had previously been wearing the gardener's hat, which I had to like screw down over my head. I had this like hard line. So that's all I could see through that whole scene. I'm like, why do I have that giant line on my head? And I asked my cousin earlier, and she's like, what do you mean, what line? I was looking at the raccoon and the thing and the blood, and like nobody's focusing on what, you know, we're focusing on about ourselves for sure.
Mm. So when you were on the show last, on our show last, you were on with JD, and you hinted some stuff about a sci-fi show that potentially were going to happen.
Yeah.
Is this something you can expand on now, or is there still an NDA creeping in the background that potentially becomes the next David Grohl to hunt you down?
NDA up the wazoo.
Okay.
It's still as exciting and fun for the 7-year-old that I was in 1977 as it was when I talked to JD about it. Like that, it's going to be fun. Sorry, I wish I could say more.
Well,
legally speaking, they said, you know, don't say anything about anything to anybody. And practically speaking, like, of course, I'm going to honor that. And also, like, you know, it's exciting. It's in the sci-fi realm, and we're all enjoying the show. And when it comes back, we'll enjoy it again.
Well, I respect all NDAs. I'm going to just poke a few questions at you and just see what kind of
comes
out of it.
Okay, good. Lie detector test. I'm ready.
So when you appear or do not appear on this upcoming sci-fi TV show that we're probably well aware of because it's been around for a couple of seasons already.
Seems like it.
Yeah. Is the character that you may or may not be playing CGI, prosthetic, or you?
Ah, well, I don't know if there's going to be any enhancement, but my experience on the day was that it's going to be 100% practical.
Okay. All right, that's good. Good answer.
I am imagining it will be my face driving the face.
Okay, very nice. Very cool. Is this a character that could be recurring on this show if you're on it, or will this be a one appearance on a show if you're on it?
I like this dance. This is fun. It would appear, based on previous experience, that should they choose to have him around, it doesn't seem outside the realm of possibility.
Okay.
That seemed pretty safe.
Yeah, that's well done. Good answer. When on this particular show that you may be on.
Or not.
Or not, of course, or not.
I don't know. Yeah.
If there, things were to happen in certain ways.
Yeah.
Are you on screen with any other characters that we may be familiar with if this were to occur?
There are two ways of answering that question. On screen with, perhaps not. Okay. In the same scene with, perhaps yes.
Wow, you did a really good job of walking the line on that question right there. Well done.
Tightrope. Is it getting hot in here, or am I just in trouble?
Well, if you ever think that, you know, we'll always edit out next, but I'm going to see if I can get one more.
Sure. This is fun. I think we can do this.
Okay. On this potential show that you may or may not be in, are you potentially a good guy or more likely a villain?
Does any villain ever think he's a villain? Or is a villain is a villain just doing what he thinks he needs to do?
Are we going to think he's a villain?
No, I think people are going to understand his point of view.
Okay, well done. Wow, professional answer.
I'm trying to give you the best absolute non-answer I possibly can.
No, you're doing good. And hopefully there are some fans of this show that may or may not be coming out for season 3 that will be parsing your words very carefully, and a whole list of rumors will spread.
Completely unassociated with me as a person.
Right. In this character, right, that you may be playing.
Yeah.
Is this a character that may have been seen before in any other type of media, in either books, cartoons, other movies? That have maybe existed over the last, 50 years that it existed? 55 years that it existed for.
My understanding is that the character itself has not been seen, though the race is familiar in the world. The race.
Let's see if you can answer this.
Okay.
What directions were you given about the character while prior to playing it? This would be a fun game show. What can I say?
But like, there's an axe hanging over here.
Right. The prize is not getting sued. there's no winner.
Like a sea of lawyers circling below you.
That would be awesome.
I don't think I really have a good answer for that one, even if I could just like speak freely about it. I think that I don't think there was a lot of specific direction in the, you know, like when you audition for something that there's any kind of NDA-ishness around, you don't typically get the real dialogue anyway. You get kind of like fake sides just for their safety, so no, it doesn't get out, you know. And even in that, it was very kind of minimal, more like stage directiony kind of stuff, you know, that would indicate to me like how I might want to play him or what the context of the scene is. I think that's about as close I can get on that one.
Are we, as our listeners and fans of this potential program, going to recognize you in the part that you're playing?
Honestly, I don't know. I mean, a lot of the characters that I played have had such like strongly changed voices because they're a monster or even in the case of evil, you know, because I'm playing so many characters, they have to pick different voices and not necessarily use mine because, like, there's Marty again, right? With this particular show, since it's the only character I'm playing, my understanding is that it will be my voice, but I don't really know. I don't have that level of self-awareness to know how I read. So I think maybe people who know me might be able to go, hey, that was very clearly you in that creature suit. I don't know if it's an I don't know. It's a guy.
I think I can ask one more that may not hopefully not get you into any kind of trouble. Is this character that you potentially are?
Yeah.
Right. is the language you're speaking English, or is this a different type of language that we're not going to be, that might have to have a subtext to it? Okay, a caption, let's say.
I know the answer. I'm just trying to think, is there anything in the answer of that that could ever possibly cause anyone any strife? I think it'll be pretty easy to understand me orally.
Okay. Very well done. I think you won our game show. Can you answer my questions?
Thank God. Oh my God. This was fun, but it's a little warm right now. I'm a little scared.
That's okay. If they watch the show and you get to trouble, we will probably be on rumors, and that'll help us out greatly on our program.
Well, I'll tell you what, when it comes around, if you want to have another chit chat, like, then I can just like,
I think you just popped out with another question then that I have to ask.
I don't know.
So you're back in the hospital. You're back in the hospital for one more
second.
Heard.
I have no idea. They haven't given us any dates. I don't know.
Okay. Well, you already figured out my next question then.
I pre-cogged you. I pre-cogged you. One.
Is that something your ability that your character is? Okay. So, you know, as someone who grew up as a kind of a sci-fi geek, you've been part of two major franchises, allegedly. You definitely were in Star Trek. I believe Picard. You had some scenes.
I can cop to that. Yeah, and then some Star Trek there.
And then you've been in another franchise, probably, that's coming out at some point in the future as you played somebody. What does the child Marty think of what you've accomplished in doing this?
I love that you asked that question, because that is usually something that I allude to anytime anyone asks me anything about what I'm doing. I'm like, I'm the happiest 5-year-old kid I know. Like, the 5-year-old Marty couldn't be happier with this weird little career niche I've kind of fallen into and developed over the years. I mean, back then I couldn't have even imagined it. And now today, like, I was just talking about this today with someone, like, I get to like be monsters and dress up like aliens and like do things. And it's fun. You know, there's a lot of stuff I could be doing in life that would not make me this happy. There's a lot of stuff in life I could probably do over time that would have been more financially savvy. And yet would I have the joy and the experience and have met the amazing, crazy, talented people that I get to work with who apply their art to me and then entrust me with to go out and like bring to life. Like, it's tons of fun. It's tons of fun.
Have you ever played a character that, or will have played a character that has or became an action figure that you got to play with?
You snuck one in there. I thought we were out of it. I thought we were home free, and now suddenly it's getting warm in here again. Let's say nothing would make me happier than to someday go, guess what? Look at this. So if and when it happens, I mean, I'll be pleased as punch. Like, the 5-year-old in me will want to play with it. Though the adult in me will be like, you better put that on the shelf. Just stop.
But deep down, are you going to play with it? You can take the package and play with it.
I'm Marty. Maybe. I'm not a keeping the package kind of kid. I think even today, unless it was like something so extraordinary that I wanted to like pass down to someone in the future, they needed a pristine bubble wrap pack. I'm a play with it kid.
I'm gonna say, as a way too old adult, I will tell you, every time I buy one of my figures, or let's call them movable, posable statues,
that works.
They're always being taken out of the packages. I always make sure they're out. I find a toy. I find it's wrong to keep a toy in a package, in my opinion. Take them out.
You don't do a save one, play one, buy two kind of
thing. Oh, I don't have that kind of money. I'll teach your salary.
That's like the hardcore.
Right, like as a teacher, some teacher salary, I can only play with one or save one.
Yeah.
And the kid in me wins out every time.
I was pretty respectful of my toys back in the day when I was a kid. Like, I didn't destroy my stuff. So I felt pretty good about opening it up, playing with it, you know, kind of letting it live to its potential as, what'd you say, posable?
Posable statues.
Statue.
Yes. See, because that sounds way more mature.
It's not a doll. It's not a doll.
See, because like I said, my wife sometimes, you know, side eyes me. I'm like, it's a posable statue. It's very manly to have a statue. You know,
right.
The Greeks did it for thousands of years.
Grown-ups made this, so a grown-up can enjoy it.
Exactly. So these franchises that we spoke about, why do you think they have survived so well the test of time? And what do you think they say about ourselves as fans of them?
I think, well, kind of moving past like the superhero Marvel world, which is its own wonderful thing. I think like the sci-fi specific, I mean, we can call it genre, we can call it like the major franchises. They seem to touch on that kind of archetypal, almost like the longing, right? There's a, like this longing for a future that we may or may not ever get to see. Like, I don't want to be a vampire for immortality, but if somehow, some way I could see what we develop into in the future, I don't know that I'd want to, but the fact that we can let our creativity run wild and develop these worlds where we can have a glimpse at like these potential futures. I mean, that hits pretty deep, right? Like, whether it be like Star Trek's kind of, I don't even know what the correct word would be to describe how they go about it, but like this vision of the world, you know, how they approach new civilizations, how they approach exploration, or kind of like the, you know, more, I guess, gritty, realistic world at war, things are broken, Star Wars kind of universe. Like either way, it's a glimpse into something that we're not really going to get to see. And rather than kind of like live in the world that we already live in, whether it be happy, sad, or dark, I think it touches on something pretty elemental to be able to kind of imagine this thing that could be out there, right?
I mean, I find that they're both so idealistic. I mean, Star Trek is such an ideal world. And Star Wars, even though it's about an empire and everything being going evil, on the one part, you still do have something like a Jedi, something that is pure, that can, if you can discover it, you can say, you know, you can do something great with it. Yeah. And there's something idealistic about that as well. Or, you know, and maybe it's also, there's a faith aspect to Star Wars, I guess, because, I mean, you have the Force and all that.
But
there's something, I think, idealistic about the idea of the potential of a Jedi. Something, someone who's inherently good will save you. You know, inherent goodness, it can exist, you know?
Even potential, though, for sure. Like, building, living into, discovering your potential, for sure. That's one of the best foundational aspects of the Star Wars world.
So, for a final question, what are you working on next?
Currently involved with shooting what season are we up to in Evil? I think season 3 in Evil.
Very cool.
And that's ongoing. I think we're kind of midway towards later side of midway through season 3 on that. I don't think I can say much about the characters per se, but yeah, that's been ongoing. We shoot that in New York, and there's probably a few more things coming up on that show before they wrap.
Well, you know, next time, whatever you're working on, whether it's Evil 3 or these other potential show that could eventually happen maybe this year, you are welcome back on the show at any time. Lovely. Sir. You are fantastic.
I greatly appreciate it. I appreciate your time. Thank you. All right. Take care.
Hey, thank you so much. Have a fantastic night, sir.